this week.
It is important to also recognize the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. But the grievances of the Palestinian people cannot justify the appalling attacks by Hamas, and those appalling attacks cannot justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people.
As the Israel-Hamas war intensifies and a humanitarian crisis unfolds, the United Nations Secretary General issues a stern warning against violating international law. But what does the law say, and what are the repercussions for violating it? We'll also look at how effective the UN has been in settling international disputes and bringing wars to an end. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello and welcome to the show. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has alleged violations of international law in Gaza and urged an immediate ceasefire as Israeli air power hammered the Palestinian territory in response to Hamas's October 7th attacks on its soil.
I have condemned unequivocally the horrifying and unprecedented 7 October acts of terror by Hamas in Israel. Nothing can justify the deliberate killing, injuring, and kidnapping of civilians or the launching of rockets against civilian targets. All hostages must be treated humanely and released immediately and without conditions. Protecting civilians can never mean using them as human shields. Protecting civilians does not mean ordering more than 1 million people to evacuate to the south, where there is no shelter, no food, no water, no medicine, and no fuel, and then continuing to bomb the south itself. I am deeply concerned about the clear violations of international humanitarian law that we are witnessing in Gaza. Let me be clear, no party to an armed conflict is above international humanitarian law.
Now, the crisis in the Middle East has left the UN Security Council deeply divided. The Council is primarily responsible for maintaining international peace and security. But with wars in Sudan, Ukraine, and now in Gaza, how effective is the Security Council, and what leverage does the world body have to bring an end to conflicts around the world? That's our focus this week as the Israeli-Hamas war intensifies and civilians are caught in the crossfire. Amid the rising death toll and devastation, there's been some relief for a small number of people. Hamas has released 2 American and 2 Israeli hostages. They were among the more than 200 people, including children, taken captive during the militant group's October 7th attacks in Israel. Meanwhile, aid has begun trickling in from Egypt's border crossing with Gaza, where hundreds of thousands of displaced civilians are seeking food and safety. Israeli airstrikes are hammering the enclave in reprisals for Hamas's attacks in Israel that killed 1,400 people. More than 4,600 Palestinians have been killed in those airstrikes. Gaza's health ministry puts that figure at closer to 6,000. Aid agencies say the humanitarian situation in Gaza is worsening by the day as food, fuel, and water run out. I'm going to bring in my guest now, Abby Maxman. She is the president and CEO of Oxfam America and joins me via Skype from Washington. Abby, so great to have you with us. Please tell us, what are your colleagues in Gaza telling you about the situation there?
Thanks so much. Currently, Oxfam has 33 staff and their families in Gaza, and we are in contact with them daily. However, it's getting more and more difficult just to stay in touch. And we are hearing from our staff in Gaza that they're under a full blackout for days now, experiencing traumatizing and terrifying airstrikes with no electricity, no landlines, no fuel. They're displaced from their homes. Some have lost their homes entirely and lost multiple family members. It is traumatic, distressing, and dire for everyone in Gaza and for their loved ones. And I'll just share, one colleague this week shared that her daughter, who had been counting down for her 12th birthday this week, and she said that the daughter has turned her comments to saying, "I hope my birthday won't be my death day." Another said she is feeling privileged to be sharing a room with only 60 people.
And that is what is so distressing about this, the children who are caught up in all of this conflict, some of whom are being held hostage, some of who have to dodge airstrikes. Abby, what do people need right now? We do know that food and water are, of course, of utmost importance, as well as fuel. Beyond that, are there other sort of short to medium term needs in Gaza that we might not realize?
Well, it's a really vital question, because that interplay between food, water, fuel can't be overstated. People have left their homes and they had nothing with them when they fled bombs, and they need almost everything. Basic supplies running out, critical needs in the basics of hygiene materials. There are reports already of scabies, diarrhea, and other diseases that we know have huge impact on children and women and families, and they're being reported due to the crowded conditions, improper sanitation. And one colleague shared of a harrowing trip just to find more clothing for herself and her daughters. People need safe shelter. About half of Palestinians in Gaza are now displaced from their homes, and many are sheltering in hospitals, churches, schools, vehicles which can't move because of the lack of fuel. People need shelter that is safe. And as the situation there remains so uncertain and dangerous, people also need a way to communicate without electricity or internet. They are feeling more cut off from the world and extremely vulnerable, finding creative ways on car batteries to charge their phones so that they can get information and share information. Access to medical care. We know that hospitals are in their last hours of fuel and are truly overwhelmed by those hit by bombs. And we know that chronic patients with chronic conditions, dialysis, cancer, oxygen, premature babies, all need reliable care. And as electricity and fuel for generators are essential for that. And what we really need is an end to hostilities so that actual life-saving aid at the levels that are required can be accessed.
Yeah, there are difficulties all around. This crisis has also highlighted the work of humanitarian aid workers. Talk to us about some of the logistical challenge around getting aid into Gaza and what could help or complicate those efforts in coming days and weeks.
Well, even before the most recent escalation, Gaza has always been a challenging place to deliver aid. And now the challenges in delivering aid are enormous. People's movement is restricted. Commercial crossings are closed. Local markets and trade are failing. Communication networks and internet have failed. And it's impossible for agencies like Oxfam and all of us to restart the scale of humanitarian operations that are necessary in the face of bombs, shells, rockets, bullets that our staff are experiencing. And without electricity and fuel, water can't be pumped. Waste can't be treated. Bakeries can't bake breads. Hospitals can't function properly or safely. Ordinary civilians have already borne the brunt of the violence, and Gaza is facing a double blow as it escalates and they're cut off from public services. And indeed, the aid, the trucks going in are like a drop in the ocean of need.
Abby, help us understand what typically happens once these aid convoys arrive in sort of a conflict zone. Where does it go and how is it distributed?
Well, aid distribution in a conflict zone is complex, to say the least. Now, typically, the organizations distributing the aid have done assessments to ensure how the aid can reach the most vulnerable as expeditiously and safely as possible, targeting children, pregnant and lactating women and mothers and elderly and others. And in many cases, large organizations were working in partnership with community volunteers and leaders to identify those people to help with the distributions. And in this case, where the need is so massive that everybody, aid workers and families and communities alike, are in such a situation, the aid being delivered is so small proportional to the need, and it's highly sensitive and complex. And these choices of who to prioritize are excruciating. And this is why we are calling for an end to the siege in addition to more aid. They have to go hand in hand. And right now it is not safe for people to access the limited amount of aid while bombs are falling. We need fuel, water, and electricity let in. and above all, an end to the violence.
Abby, of course, as you just said, you're asking people to donate. Organizations such as yours and others are asking people to give, knowing that there are complicated situations on the ground. How can donors be sure that the money they give goes to those in need and that it doesn't end up in the wrong hands in the fog of war?
Well, right now, Oxfam is funding and supporting two partners who we've long worked with inside Gaza, the Palestine Medical Relief Society and the Culture and Free Thought Association. They are two of the largest health and human rights organizations in Gaza. We've worked with them a long time, and they're serving local communities through direct delivery of things that are basic and so needed, hygiene kits, cash for food, but they're reaching hundreds, not the tens of thousands of households that we need. Now, we as Oxfam have worked in Israel and occupied Palestinian territory for decades, and we have stringent systems to place in order to ensure our aid gets to the people who need it most, and we have clear processes to prevent and respond to risks of aid diversion that people are concerned about. And these are regularly checked through independent audits at project and organizational levels. So we are confident, as our staff are so committed, our partners are, to address this massive need and crisis at this time.
Abby, okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for your time. Abby Maxman is the president and CEO of Oxfam America. We wish you all the best in doing all this important work. Well, debate is heating up at the UN Security Council over the Middle East crisis. We'll take a look at the Israel-Hamas war and international law. We're going to be back in a moment.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in
cancer is one of the most successfully preventable and, if diagnosed early, one of the most treatable forms of cancer. But according to the World Health Organization, 70,000 women in Africa die every year due to cervical cancer. On this week's episode of Our Voices, we will discuss what cervical cancer is. We will also hear from experts on ways to ensure increased medical access for timely detection, care, and prevention. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
We are here today to stop the killing, to stop the massacres being committed against the Palestinian people. The ongoing massacres being deliberately and systematically and savagely perpetrated by Israel, the occupying power, against the Palestinian civilian population under its illegal occupation must be stopped. The Security Council has a duty to stop them. The international community is obliged under international law to stop them. It is our collective human duty to stop them. Now, continued failure at this council is inexcusable.
As we meet here today, young babies, children are held in Gaza. This is beyond imagination. A living nightmare. These kids witness horror which cannot be described by word. Mr. Secretary General, in what world do you live? Definitely, this is not our world. This massacre will go down in history as more brutal than ISIS. Hamas are new Nazis. Hamas are the new Nazis. Just as the civilized world united to defeat the Nazis. Just as the civilized world united to defeat ISIS. The civilized world has to stand united behind Israel to defeat Hamas.
The foreign affairs ministers of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, they're addressing a divided UN Security Council earlier this week. Both sides in the Israel-Hamas war are accusing each other of violating international law. But what does international law say? What are the repercussions for violating it? And how effective is the UN these days in settling international disputes and helping bring wars to an end? My guests are VOA's United Nations correspondent, Margaret Bashir. She joins us from the UN headquarters in New York. Also with us is Zaha Hassan. She is a human rights lawyer and a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace with a focus on Palestine-Israel peace. A warm welcome to both of you ladies. And Margaret, I'm going to start out with you. Tell us what is going on at the United Nations at the moment. We saw the sort of back and forth at the UN Security Council. We played some of those clips earlier. But of course, the cameras have been on the war itself right now, but help us understand what the conversation is at the UN and particularly at the UN Security Council.
Thanks, Heidi. Well, at the UN Security Council on Tuesday, we had a lot of ministers fly in for this meeting, and the calls are growing here for a humanitarian ceasefire. 2 weeks of watching every night on the news, Palestinian civilians being dug from the rubble, hospitals where they're treating them. It's affecting the street in the Middle East, and their leaders are here to say it. And they called on the UN to intervene, to have a humanitarian ceasefire. And that's really the main conversation here. And the UN is desperate, as you heard from Abby, like other aid organizations, to get more aid in. Only 54 trucks have confirmed that they've gone in since Saturday. There were supposed to be more on Tuesday, but we didn't get a final count of how many had gone in. So the situation is really dire, and we're hearing it from all corners, not just Arab foreign ministers, but also other governments in the global south.
Zaha, we saw the Israeli foreign ministers demanding the resignation of the UN chief, Antonio Guterres, for saying the October 7 attacks by Hamas, quote, did not happen in a vacuum. That was, of course, part of a statement he made. But do these sort of tensions put us past a point of diplomatic solutions to this crisis, at least right now?
To get to a ceasefire and to a point where we can start addressing the humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding in front of us, then it really remains to be seen what value there is anymore in having a United Nations. I mean, let's think about this for a second. United Nations was created after World War II so that never again would we see the kinds of mass atrocities that took place before and during that war. Things like the aggressive actions to subjugate populations, genocidal killing and ethnic cleansing. The mandate of the UN is to maintain international peace and security, as you mentioned, and to prevent war crimes and crimes against humanity from happening in the first place. Now, after Hamas's attack on Israel October 7th that saw the killing of 1,400 people, Israel began what is now almost 3 weeks of bombing in Gaza and has killed up to or almost 6,000 people, according to the Euromed Human Rights Monitor. The monitor is reporting that 1,500 of these are civilians. How can the Secretary General remain indifferent to this killing or justify it at all as self-defense? He can't. And what he has done and what we heard him do yesterday was to condemn both the Hamas killings of Israeli civilians, and he called on Israel to stop the bombardment of the civilian population of Gaza. I mean, that is the very least he can do. We're at a moment right now where many legal experts are now talking about whether or not we're seeing a genocide being committed in Gaza in real time. The UN Secretary General called it collective punishment of Palestinians in Gaza. We have 8 hospitals at this moment that have been closed because they don't have fuel. So the situation is growing incredibly urgent, and we need UN action now to call for a ceasefire.
And Margaret, that does make me wonder about the kind of weight that the UN Secretary General's words carry. I mean, there was also a second part, of course, and Zaha alluded to this, to what he said. He said, yes, the October 7 attacks did not happen in a vacuum, but he continued to say but that grievances cannot justify violence. So he did seem to rebuke almost both sides. But is that part of the frustration here, that he is not taking a stand on one side or another? And how much weight do his words carry?
Well, I don't know how much weight his words carry, because he's been calling for the, you know, violence to stop, and it hasn't stopped. And it's not like he just started calling for it to stop 2 weeks ago. The United Nations has been looking at the Israeli-Palestinian file for decades. And so I don't know how much of it is the Secretary General's personal failing. He is only as strong as the member states that he works with. And if there's no political will among them to resolve root causes and differences and stop wars, then they're not going to stop. We're seeing that in many places in the world. And then you have the Security Council, which is its own beast, and it's the most powerful organ in the United Nations. But particularly since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, we've seen it really geopolitical divisions are pulling it apart on important files, and things aren't getting done. And case in point, today we're probably going to have a vote in the Council. The United States has put forward a resolution having to do with Israel and Gaza, and the Russians said yesterday they're putting forward one now. And this comes after 2 other resolutions were put forward in the Council last week. So the Council is not doing its job. We certainly heard that yesterday from many of the Arab foreign ministers, from Riyad al-Maliki, who you played, the Palestinian foreign minister. There is a lot of anger that the Security Council has been failing the Palestinians for decades, that they have failed to deliver on this two-state solution.
Zaha, help us understand. We've heard the UN Secretary General warn against violating international humanitarian law in the Israel-Hamas conflict. What does the law say, especially when it comes to the kind of wording around murder, hostage-taking, attacks on civilians and civilian settlements, war of aggression? I mean, how do you even enforce this when one side is a state, the other isn't? I mean, and one side believes it has a right to self-defense. Where does self-defense end and a war of aggression begin?
Well, let's start with Hamas. Hamas is a resistance group. It's operating in a situation of military occupation by Israel. Gaza is Israeli-occupied territory. What Palestinian groups have is a right to resist occupation under international law, but they have to respect the laws of war, just like any state would, and avoid targeting civilians while resisting occupation. So the killing of civilians and the taking of civilian hostages would be a violation of the laws of war, as would be firing rockets indiscriminately into Israeli territory. But Israel also has duties as an occupying power. It has a duty to Palestinian civilians under its jurisdiction and control in Gaza. Now, it's supposed to be protecting Palestinian civilians from harm because it has security control over the Gaza Strip. But what what we know as well is that Israel is maintaining a 16-year-old illegal siege over Gaza, according to the UN. And that siege, we see it in real time now, how it can be used to restrict access to food and medicine, electricity and fuel, things that Palestinians need for their essential survival. So what do the laws of war have to say about this? The laws of war, international humanitarian law, again, both the Israeli side and Hamas are prohibited from targeting civilians. But in the case of Israel, we have a duty as well from Israel to Palestinian civilians, not just to Israeli civilians, but to Palestinian civilians, because they're the occupying power. They're under a duty to refrain from excessive force, and they are required to distinguish between civilians and non-civilians, combatants. But what we've seen and what Human Rights Watch has documented was, you know, even the use of white phosphorus against the civilian population. We've seen the targeting of hospitals. We've seen, again, the denial of fuel that's going to end up closing hospitals and making it impossible for them to treat the 16,000 folks who've been wounded because of the collapse of buildings, because of the bombing attacks. And so this is all in violation of the Geneva Convention. You cannot argue that that's within Israel's right to self-defense. Israel's self-defense is to protect its citizens from harm. It's not a carte blanche to attack the civilian population on the other side, a population that, again, is supposed to be protected by the occupying power, which is Israel here. Another issue that we're seeing is forced population transfer. 1 million people in Gaza have now been forcibly removed from their homes. Their homes have been demolished. 150,000 homes have been destroyed or partially destroyed. And Israel's telling them to leave, to go to Egypt. This is a violation of the laws of war. It constitutes population transfer. It's a war crime. So we're seeing all kinds of violations of the laws of war in this case. And yet we don't, as your previous guest said, we don't see a political will to enforce the law.
Margaret, we've got about 2 minutes here. What has your reporting over the years revealed about what the UN can accomplish and what it cannot in a conflict like this one?
Well, I think just look at Ukraine for a recent example. The Secretary General has said that he sees no opening on the horizon for a political solution to the war. So he's not been running to Kyiv and Moscow for photo ops with the leaders there, you know, trying to make it like he's doing something. He's acknowledged that there's just no political will. So he's doubled down where the UN can make a difference on things like humanitarian assistance. The UN has helped 9 million Ukrainians this year. And on the Black Sea Grain Initiative, which when it worked for nearly a year, it worked pretty well. So, and that was to help get grain and food and fertilizer products out of Ukraine and Russia to the rest of the world to help ease the food insecurity crisis and rising food prices. So the UN does what it can. We've also seen it in Sudan most recently. Very difficult situation. The UN's political person was kicked out by the government. So they really couldn't make any headway there, but they have been delivering aid in Kordofan and Darfur. So they're trying. It's not enough, but they're trying where they can.
Well, the situation will most likely probably just heat up. We will continue this conversation in future with the two of you. Thank you so much, Zaha Hassan and Margaret Bashir, for your time. I do appreciate it. And that is our show for this week. A big thanks, of course, to all my guests and to you, our audience, for being with us. Do let us know your thoughts on social media. It was a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you for always watching and for always listening. Until next time, goodbye.